Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome James Russell. He's the author of the children's book, How to Turn Your Parents Green. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello.
So this is an adorable and very interesting little children's book. Was this inspired by your own child?
It was inspired by my children. I have a 9-year-old girl, Miranda, and a 5-year-old boy, Oliver. And Miranda in particular was starting to learn about the environment and about climate change at school. And she and her friends were obviously a little anxious about it and didn't really understand the big issues. So I wrote the book partly to introduce them in a sort of amusing and really child-friendly way.
And it's interesting, as a book for children, it really takes the issues very seriously, but in a light and often hilarious way.
Yes, I think issues, you know, climate change is obviously the biggest one, but it's ecology in general, and I think it does need to be taken very seriously. But unfortunately, I've seen throughout my career as a writer that when you try to talk to people too directly and too seriously and too earnestly, they have a habit of switching off.
And so you made up a term, a number of terms, but one of them is groaners. What's a groaner?
Well, the idea was that you had the grown-ups, the adults, who had sort of got the world into the mess that it is now.
And that would be us.
That's us. That's mum and dad. That's, you know, everyone who isn't a kid anymore. And apart from greens, you could say. But anyway, the groans, as I call them in the book, are the antithesis of the greens. They're sort of your average, modern, sort of fairly indolent adult who drives everywhere and doesn't really think too much about their consumption and, you know, the way they live. And it was just a way of creating a foil for the book, a sort of comic foil to sort of aim at.
And so the children are basically, who read the book, are put in a position where they're able to educate their parents.
Yeah, I mean, it's very lighthearted. I think what I wanted to do was get people talking. And I think within families, what you find now in Britain in particular is that children are learning an awful lot about the environment at school, and they're learning a lot of really good things and doing amazing things at school. And then at home, they get home and it's a different world, and then perhaps isn't the communication that there could be. So this is a way of for the kids to say to the adults, you know, hey, why aren't you recycling? You know, let's get you doing that. But in a funny way, not in a sort of hectoring, lecturing sort of way.
No, and it's hilarious because there are little sheets that children can create where they fine their parents, you know, 25 cents or 20 pence or whatever it is for various offenses, like leaving the lights on and not recycling aluminum cans.
Yeah, I got into trouble about that really because there was an article in the Times in London where someone was taking it all very seriously and saying, this is dreadful that, you know, children should be, you know, turning against their parents and stuff. But the idea is that the kids perhaps can find a way to earn a little bit of pocket money. And it, as I said, it gets everyone talking and thinking about the issues.
And so there are a lot of things in it that is just really good information for children. For example, the difference between recycling an aluminum can and making a new aluminum can. Who knew that you could so thoroughly and completely recycle an aluminum can?
Well, this was something I really found out when I was researching the book. I knew that there was, you know, aluminum is a particularly good metal for recycling, but I had no idea quite. I mean, it's something like you recycle a can and it's a sort of 95% efficiency, something like that.
And you use a tiny amount of the energy that's used in making a new can.
Right, because making aluminum in the first place is very energy intensive. And yet, you know, we all throw away billions of these things every day. And they're not given a cash value. And I think, you know, trying to give these things a sort of, I don't know, moral value in a way is a different way of looking at it.
There's I was calling them groaners, the groans. The groans have, they don't look too good in this book, and there's kind of an anti-chocolate bias. The groans are always sitting in their armchairs watching television and eating chocolate.
Well, the illustrations from the book, I have to say, the illustrations were done by this a Norwegian artist who lives in the same British city where I live, which is Bristol, which is quite a green city, really. And he's a hilarious.
He's a great artist.
Yeah, he's a hilarious illustrator, very talented, very good. I sent him off to just do his own thing. I had no input into what he did, and he came up with these fantastic and slightly grotesque illustrations, particularly of the grown-ups who, I don't know who his models were, but they're fairly kind of cutting for grown-ups.
And there's a little bit of a kind of 1960s aesthetic in the drawings as well.
I know. There is a 60s aesthetic, and there's a sort of, you know, I have a slightly 60s agenda. I think that the young need to get, and they are doing, starting to, need to become a lot more radical and involved, and they need inspiration. There needs to be a sort of a new radical, environmentalism, which is perhaps different from what's gone before, but is more kind of engaging and more interesting than, you know, some of the things that are going on.
I think that one of the things that your book can do is it can really give children a new way of looking at the world in which we live. I mean, I was reading it last night when I was out somewhere, and when I was walking back to my car, I saw a beetle walking across the cement sidewalk, and I thought, you know, we're all sharing habitat together. This beetle and I are walking down this sidewalk, and we have different needs. And I was just thinking about the beetle a little differently, having read your book.
Well, that is absolutely what it's about. I mean, it's a my wife described it as a consciousness-raising book, which is something I hadn't really thought about. It's sort of a manifesto in a way. It is about looking at the world in different ways, not in one way, but in different ways. That it is very much about ecology in the broadest sense. You know, we all live in cities now, and the nature that surrounds us has to cohabit with us in the cities. In Britain, we've reached a point where gardens, suburban gardens, are now the best natural habitats in the country. So, people and nature live together, and kids, unfortunately, are spending far too much time in front of computers and so on these days. And I want them to start looking at the world around them with a critical eye and an inspired eye.
We're talking to James Russell, author of the book How to Turn Your Parents Green. There's a number of ideas in the book. One of them, which I don't think I've ever done, I've thought of it, but I've never done it, is No Power Day. I mean, you leave your refrigerator on, but other than that, you don't turn anything on. You don't use anything that is powered by electricity.
Yeah, I mean, these are ideas that are really, again, designed to sort of get people thinking. I mean, that actually is very much how the Sabbath works in Israel. I mean, when I spent some time in Israel, and it really struck me that idea that you don't use power during this time, this particular time in the week. It was a very powerful idea. So I suppose that's where that came from. But in this case, I was just sort of trying to think of different ways in which children and, of course, their families, their parents, could look at the way of what they're using every day that we all take for granted and start thinking about it in a different way.
Now, have you done this in your family, the No Power Day?
We haven't specifically done that. We've done, lots of different sort of experiments that are slightly similar. But I suppose the nearest we come to it is when we go camping. And, we tend to take off from home and for 72 hours or whatever it is, a few days, live very, very, very simply. That's the sort of, I suppose that's the nearest we've come to it.
I have to say, as somebody who is currently preparing for a camping trip, even living simply is pretty complicated when you think about all the stuff you pack as gear to go even camping. And it is an illustration of how complicated our lives have become.
It is very difficult to be simple. And I think it becomes increasingly difficult. And I think it's funny when you see children and you put them in a context which is very basic. Like the other day we were up at the Arroyo by St. John's where there was a little water running. And the kids were just building dams and splashing about. And they were there for hours. And that was all there was. There were some rocks, you know, some sand and mud and some water. And they were absolutely blissfully happy. And yet we spend all of our time trying to load children with new computer games and new toys and new technologies, which they don't need at all.
And you can also, when they get done playing those things, the look on their face is a really different look than when they get done playing in the water.
Right. I mean, there are certain forms of play and activity for kids which are relaxing and invigorating and inspiring. And I would include, you know, any kind of playing outdoors in the dirt, any kind of exploration when they're exploring for themselves in a real environment. You contrast that with the kind of stimulus you get from playing a computer game whenever, you know, my son comes off a computer game and he's wired.
Right.
It's a completely different experience.
One of the things you mention in the book, and you're writing to children, and you're basically saying something which I think is completely true, which is that they don't have the freedom that we had when we were their age. What's that about?
Well, I mean, this is a whole other story, which is, I think, an enormous and very, very important story about the way the world has changed, particularly in the way we live with cars and the way that we now live at a distance from everything we do and commute to everything that we do. And children now, I was talking about this with some friends in Santa Fe just the other day, that they don't just go out and play on the block with their friends. They don't go out and just go exploring and riding their bikes by themselves because we don't feel it's safe, partly because people are very scattered and populations of children are very scattered, so you don't get these sort of neighborhood gangs of little kids running around. I think this is, you know, this is a great shame. And you have to now really go out of your way to cultivate that kind of environment for your kids.
It's very difficult because even if you let's say you have one or two children and you let your children go out and play, nobody else is doing it. So, the park near where I live, there's rarely children in it. And when they're mostly either on a sports, you know, practice thing or accompanied by their parents.
Well, this is something which I think is true. It's certainly true all over Britain. I think it's probably true all over the developed world that we've created an environment where children tend to be either in the home or they're out supervised by adults. And in England, they love surveys in England, and they've done lots of surveys on this and discovered that now there are very, very, very few parents who would ever let children under 10 unaccompanied out in the world, whereas 20 years ago, it might have been common for children of 7 or 8 to be out.
Well, I mean, heck, we walked to school from the time we were 5 or 6 years old on, and that was a pretty long way. I mean, it makes you feel like you're some 19th century person talking about their 5-mile walk on the prairie, but it's starting to seem that way.
It certainly is. I mean, I remember vividly walking to school with a little gang of kids, and the older ones would always take charge of the younger ones. And that was a very, very important learning experience. I think it was as important as what you learned at school.
Absolutely.
You know, what you learn on those times when you're in the world without adults, that is how you develop a relationship with the environment that you live in.
Very much so, including the natural environment. And so, I mean, I remember running around in the woods and around ponds with my, you know, usually one or two little friends. And that's where you learn about, you know, frogs, trees, lily pads, water, algae, and all of those things. And it's a lot of it is nonverbal learning.
Absolutely. And I think in order to create the next generation of people like Rachel Carson or just the people who support the Audubon Society, to create those generation of people who are interested in nature, kids have to have opportunities to experience the world around them for themselves and by themselves, maybe with other children, but not through the mediation of adults and certainly not through TV and computers.
We're talking to James Russell, author of the children's book, How to Turn Your Parents Green. There's an interesting question that I've been thinking about lately. I mean, there are some things, for example, not running your water when you're brushing your teeth, or, you know, putting your appliances on a power strip and turning it off so that they're not on standby, that makes no impact whatsoever on your actual life. But then there are other things like turning your power off altogether or bicycling to work, which are real changes in lifestyle. And, you know, people make personal choices about what of those things they want to do. Do they want to stop watching their TV altogether? But then you can get into a kind of eco-culture where you have this whole group of people who basically wants you to sit in the dark wearing 8 layers of itchy long johns, eating organic cabbage and singing Kumbaya, which, you know, I mean, I'd shoot me now. I mean, if that's our future.
Well, that unfortunately, and I think this is perhaps the case even more in the United States than it is in England, that the green movement has a very poor reputation for a sort of, you know, sandal wearing kind of granola munching kind of, you know, killjoy culture. And
sandals are great.
Sandals are
great. Granola
is
great. The killjoy is not great.
Yeah. And I think that's unfortunate. And I don't believe that people should be told what to do. And I don't believe that people should be denied from living in an interesting, you know, and entertaining way. What I do think, though, is that quite often what we perceive now as the great things that we own, like our, you know, ability to use lots of energy and to drive everywhere and to, you know, have all our entertainment on huge TV screens and that sort of thing, I think in a way we're denying ourselves and, more importantly, denying children other ways of enjoying the world. And I think, you know, you can think of an enormous number of things. For example, learning a musical instrument, which takes time, application, effort, and it's difficult. And if you only take easy options all the time, you won't ever do it.
And it's interesting because, I mean, if all of our power were to just suddenly come from solar and wind and nothing else, and we were still watching TV and listening to MP3s all the time, an opportunity would be lost.
I think that's right. I mean, to me, it's you know, the energy use and the impact of climate change and so on, these are sort of one side of the story, but I think it's a much, much bigger story than that. And I think culturally, we're losing a great deal by allowing ourselves to become consumers of everything rather than creating and producing for ourselves. And I think if you want to be, you know, if you want to be independent and you want to have independent creative kids, then they need opportunities to look at the world in other ways than is perhaps the norm. Without saying that people should be denied any of these things, it's simply making the mix a bit more, a bit richer and a bit more interesting.
One of the things that your book does very nicely is it shows some examples of interconnections. So it starts with your beautiful wooden patio deck and then talks about the destruction of oak trees, which provide acorns, which in turn feed wild boars, which in turn are prey for tigers, which in turn, when too many oak trees are taken away, are going extinct.
Yeah, I mean, that whole little story came out of a project that my daughter did at school.
I can't remember what part of the world this...
This is Siberia,
right.
The tigers were in. And she'd just been doing a project about... And it seemed to me very sad, first of all, that her generation, rather than learning about the natural world as a sort of wonderful and extraordinary place, are learning about it almost exclusively as something under threat. And that, you know, all these animals are threatened with extinction. But the interconnectedness, I think it's very hard to get across to people that in their everyday choices, simple, you know, everyday things that you about your shopping and so on, everything that you do has an impact. And of course, there's lots of people here in Santa Fe who in New Mexico who are very well aware of that. But it's just an entertaining way of making a connection between something like patio furniture and the fate of an animal.
Now, tell us a little bit about the publishing of this book. Are you selling it in the United States?
It's available on Amazon. At the moment, the way the book started out was I got together with a local small publisher in the city where I live, who is also a parent, and we got together and came up with this idea. And then the book got taken up by the major British environmental publisher called Green Books. They are sort of looking to get the book distributed in America. But what I think may happen is I may produce an American version.
That uses American, Celsius as a, I mean, Fahrenheit versus Celsius.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to change the style because sometimes, it's quite British and it is quite, there are words that people will say, what does that mean? That's a very English expression.
Rubbish.
Rubbish, yeah. But I think there are references which need to change for an American audience. But I really think that this will happen. It's a question of me negotiating with all these different people who are involved to come up with a way of doing it.
One of the things that you just touch on, which I think is interesting to explore for young people, is spotting greenwashing. What is greenwashing?
Well, greenwashing is basically when a company who has been criticized for, say, a classic one would be an oil company. People say, oil companies are, polluters, they have a bad reputation. And so the company then presents itself as being green. It'll say something like, we're carbon neutral because we do this and that and the other. And certainly in Britain, this is becoming a huge business. And basically every company that you look at is now developing green credentials of one kind and another, often without changing anything they do.
Right. And when young people are savvy to that, they'll be a whole bunch of steps ahead in terms of the choices that they make.
Absolutely. I mean, it's part of the whole business of being a consumer who's alert to what's going on. And we are now all consumers, of everything that we do is bought from somebody, every sort of, product that we buy. You can choose. You have the power to choose one thing over another. And children have an enormous, enormous power, economic power, which many companies are very happy to exploit. And it's time, kids need to say, hang on a minute, this company I want to buy from, what are they like? Where does this come from? Is the product being made by children somewhere?
Right.
I
was wondering if the anti-chocolate bias was really based in the fact that a lot of chocolate is made by child slave, essentially slave labor.
The anti-chocolate bias is something I hadn't really noticed, actually. I quite like chocolate. But
The groans are always eating chocolate biscuits.
Oh, the chocolate biscuits. That's right. Yeah. I think there's something about, it's more of wanting the whole packet, isn't it? It's that sort of idea that, nowadays, it's very strange. The idea that you could have just a little bit of a luxury as a treat. Nowadays, we want to have the luxury all the time.
That's right.
And this isn't very fun because if you do that, what are your treats?
Well, and that whole line of thought leads to conversations about measure and balance, which are part of the whole ecological, conversation that this book is engaging.
Yeah, balance, I think, is absolutely fundamental. And I think at the moment, and I think most people would agree, that we are out of balance. It doesn't mean that people have to, go around wearing hair shirts and being miserable to make up for it. But there is a sort of, things have gone a bit out of kilter, and it's going to be our children, their generation, who are sort of dealing with problems that are now beginning to emerge. And climate change is obviously the most obvious, but also in the way people live and their relationship with computers and cars and technology in general. And there's going to be some, there's going to be some big challenges ahead, and achieving balance is really, what it's all about.
Any reports so far from parents and children who've used the book?
Well, I was a bit nervous because the they were very involved with my kids' school, and when the book came out, all the kids, you know, wanted to buy a copy. And a few of the parents started to get a little bit anxious. I noticed a lot of low energy light bulbs appearing in people's houses, and the parents,
well,
some
there
of them
you have
were,
it.
Yeah, some of the parents were, some of the kids apparently were getting a little bit dictatorial. But in general, the feedback I've had has been very, very good, and you know, it has done what I hoped it would do, which was really to get people thinking and talking, and getting people inspired to look at the world more imaginatively.
The book is How to Turn Your Parents Green by James Russell. It's hilarious. It's beautifully illustrated. It's available on Amazon.com. James Russell, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're listening to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Patsy Phillips. She's the new director of the Institute of American Indian Arts Museum, and Joseph Sanchez. He is the deputy director of the IAIA Museum and chief curator, and he curated the exhibition Fritz Schulder, An Intimate Look, which opens today from 4 to 6 in the afternoon at the museum and runs through February 15th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to have you both here. So let's talk about Fritz Schulder for a moment. Who was he? How would you describe in a few moments his life story as an artist?
Who was he? One of our first early professors in the 60s.
So, and to remind people, IAIA is first and foremost a school,
yes,
and then a museum
college.
On top of that.
Yes, we have the museum is part of the school as well. And Fritz was one of our early teachers, and of course one of the most well-known of the native artists worldwide, actually. And he coined the whole Indian art scene in a way with the early paintings of the monster Indians. And so he kind of spurred the entire Santa Fe art scene in a lot of ways.
It's such an interesting combination of cultures that he brings to it, because he was one quarter Indian, as you see in some of the work in the exhibition, but he didn't exactly consider himself an Indian or an Indian artist per se.
Yeah, he didn't call himself an Indian artist. He considered himself an American artist, and he was one quarter Luseño, but he was also German, and it was, part of his thing. He just wanted to be an artist, and was a very prolific artist on top of that as well.
And so let's talk about some of that early work. I mean, as you were sort of starting to say, he really did not romanticize the Indian world at all, sort of to the contrary.
I think if you come to the show, you'll see the early works, which have tremendous insight into who Native people are and the struggles they've had following the like a post-colonial environment. So the works are very insightful in terms of who the people were and the struggles that they're having. And that was early on. That's in the 70s with the Indians Forever series.
Including drunkenness and all sorts of things.
Yes, and things that still happen today, of course. Those insights still are part of today's life in Native America.
Now, he also was very much a painter of his time and influenced by some of the great American and European artists of the 20th century.
You'll see kind of shades of Francis Bacon, a little Manet. He was a very studious artist. He loved to read. He was a collector, made books, worked in all media all the time. So he was a sculptor, a printer, a painter.
The prints are really a major part of this exhibition, and they're stunning. Tell us about the series of prints of all kinds.
Yes, we focused a lot on the early prints, which are the early Native prints, the ones called Indians Forever. And later on, by 1970, that was the early 70s. Later on, he moved to a series called 10 Indians, which are the different Indian tribes. And then he did a series of prints, large Aquatint etchings that were done in Rome, and that's the Roma series. So they're very, very large-scale prints, 44 by 66 inches. And some of the largest, at that time, was the largest printing press in the world to print etchings.
Now, you were friends with him. Well, you're an artist yourself, which I think we should mention.
I had a studio that was across the street on this little street in Scottsdale called Cattle Track Road. So I lived across the street from him for 22 years. So I did know him. I attended a lot of exhibitions, and he was on my board, on a foundation board I had a couple of times. So it was nice. I spent got times talking to him and stuff.
We're talking about the exhibition Fritz Schulder, An Intimate Look, which is opening today at the Institute of American Indian Arts Museum right here in downtown Santa Fe, across the street from the Cathedral of Santa Fe. What was it like for you? I mean, it's a really wonderful position, I think, for you to be in, having been so familiar with not only the person's work, but the person for so long, and then you get to go into their studios. He passed away a few years ago, and make a lot of decisions about how to put together the show.
Well, it was, for me, I'd seen really a lot of the work and kind of knew a lot of his interests. Been in his house a lot because he did collect all this material, so I knew what his interests might be. And so it wasn't very hard to say, well, I want to start with the Prince series, the early Indian Prince, and then move on into all the other areas, that he's, the mystery women, which saw lots of mystery women.
What's the mystery women all about?
Well, there were a lot of women around Fritz, and he painted a lot of women. So, there's a lot of women in his paintings. The series, I think, lasted his entire career of mystery women. But each year he would do all kinds of series, these shaman portraits. This show is filled with a lot of number ones from different series, which we're very fortunate to have. And one of the largest paintings, which is 217 inches, that's an untitled painting done in the year 2000. So which kind of covers his entire life and all the different series, because he did Human in Nature, he did The Mystery Women, he painted about possession, he painted about shaman.
It's interesting when you have an artist who does so many series as opposed to unrelated discrete paintings, then you as the curator have to decide how many in the series you're going to put up.
And, this is such a prolific artist that the choices were, we did a lot. We did over 100 paintings and prints, so it wasn't that hard to edit out. He did thousands of paintings, so. And I'd seen a lot of them, and a lot of them are going to be in New York and in Washington. The National Museum of the American Indian is having a huge retrospective that'll open in November, as well as in New York City, which will feature the New York paintings. So that's going to be a really exciting thing that we're lucky to kind of follow.
As we were talking about before, because we walked through the show a little bit earlier, there's in the very kind of genteel museum atmosphere, you look at the walls and there's this intense sexuality, vampire, death, spirit possession, all these kind of things in this show. It's a really charged show.
Well, I think he is an artist that was interested in a lot of subjects, and it's really evident, and I tried to portray that in this work, that he was curious about a lot of subjects, and he studied a lot of subjects, and he collected like ancient books, and that's reflected in the work. So there's mythical people in some of the works that you can talk about, as well as it is charged, his relationship, and you can see that as much as the early Indian work is as charged as the sexual element that you see in some of the other paintings, So he was just a powerful artist, and he influenced a lot of artists. So it's great.
And his favorite color was?
Purple.
I love that you painted the walls of some of the rooms purple.
Oh, yes. That's for a lot of years, his car was purple. His house was purple. His clothes were purple. He liked purple. And a very ecclesiastical, I call it, a royal purple.
Right. And he seemed like somebody who kind of lived fast and did absolutely everything fully.
Well, he said, he wanted to live. He was all about being alive. And he did everything he could to be alive. And I think that's reflected in a show like this. The energy and the power and his inquisitive mind. It's nice to share that now, that he left a great legacy of paintings and information for us to kind of ponder.
Patsy Phillips.
When I lived in Phoenix, Arizona for a number of years, about 10 years ago, and I got to know Fritz Scholder. And what Joseph is saying, I just want to endorse, because Fritz was just, he loved life. And he collected, and Joseph's catalog is an actual speech that he's given. Is that correct?
Yes.
Joseph, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, he'd like to write, and he made books, and he did quite a few convocation speeches, so we reprinted one in the catalog that he did for ASU. And he's just encouraging young people not only to study, but to reach out, travel, and not to give up on any kind of dream, and to live as much today as you can, to be energetic about it. And, you know, there might not be tomorrow. And, you know, if you're an artist, you know, paint everything you can at about every subject, you know, not... Don't lock yourself into a corner, and don't listen to other what people say about your work.
Yeah, I heard him give that speech a couple of times, and it really truly was inspiring. People would give him a standing ovation afterwards. But basically, he said, "Travel, get out there." He's really trying to encourage. He said, "Just get as much exposure as you can to the world."
It sounds like the same message that Sherman Alexie gave when he spoke here in Santa Fe.
Hmm.
Saying, you know, it was actually interesting. Sherman Alexie said, "Get off the res,
mm-hmm.
go everywhere." So Fritz Scholder died in 2005.
Yes.
And the studios that he left, one was in Arizona, one was here in New Mexico, and I mean, were they just left intact? I mean, the last thing he painted was still on the what shape are they in? And how did you gather the work for the show?
Well, Scottsdale Studio is like that, because that's where he painted the last years of his life, you know. And there's the easel still set up, you know, the paints are out. And the widow was, you know, she was intent on leaving it that way. You know, it's kind of a memory, you know, and he was working up to the last minute, literally. You know, he never gave up trying to work, so it's nice to see that, you know, to walk in and... He had so much stuff around him, you know. His house was kind of as dense as the exhibition. You know, there were objects everywhere, you know, and things he was working on and books he were reading or prints he was proofing. It's just, like, full. And that's why the show, to me, is full, you know, because his life was full like that. You know, when you were around him, there was a painting here, there was a sculpture there, there was something everywhere. And I wanted people to have that feeling of, there's a painting here, and there's one. As you looked around, you could see all the kind of, they're behind you, they're in front of you, they're beside you. And his house was kind of that way in his studio.
And let's not forget the sculptures.
And the sculptures, yes. I think he loved sculpture. I think that was one of his favorite things. He did a lot of sculpture. We only have three pieces in the show, but he did really a lot. And a lot of small ones that never were realized really large scale. But there's quite a few large-scale pieces as well.
There's a series of martyrs. There's a couple of them, of those
mm-hmm.
sculptures in the show. How do you understand conceptually the martyrs series?
Well, I think for me it's like when he sacrificed his self as an artist for the world to have a better view of where we're headed. So.
Do you think he sacrificed himself? The man with a purple Porsche, a Rolls Royce, a house full of stuff, multiple women.
Yeah. Well, I think so. You know, he would consider that. You know, that, you know, he gave everything he could for his art. His art was primarily what he was interested in. And he poured everything he had into that. I think it's evident in the work. And if he was talking about martyring anything, it would be himself, that he just gave it all the way to the last minute. You know.
We're talking to Joseph Sanchez, who is the curator of the exhibition Fritz Scholder, An Intimate Look. And Patsy Phillips is the new director of the Institute of American Indian Arts Museum, which is where this show is opening today from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. First of all, welcome to Santa Fe.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
You were before at the Museum of the American, the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C., which is part of the Smithsonian. Tell us about the work that you did there.
I joined the Smithsonian in 2000, and part I was hired to project manage one of the inaugural exhibitions. And so my first few years, I was very involved in the opening, the planning of the opening. The museum actually opened on the mall in September 2004. But in 2003, I started developing the contemporary art initiatives that the museum now is supporting. But we, one of our big goals was to take contemporary Native arts to Venice. And so in 2003, we supported, and I managed a reception for Shelley Nero in Venice. And then in 2005, we took James Luna, the NMAI sponsored James Luna's exhibit in Venice. And then 2007, Edgar Heap of Birds. So my work in 2004 started focusing solely on contemporary arts.
So what are some of your goals for Santa Fe, for the Institute of American Indian Arts Museum here?
One of the last things that I headed up before I left NMAI was a strategic plan for contemporary arts. And now it took us almost 2 years to implement, to actually establish this. And so what I plan to do here is to gather a team of both staff, college, some representatives from the college, and then maybe a couple of alum, but for us to come together and to develop a strategic plan for IAI's museum, and a plan that will complement what the NMAI in Washington is doing. The NMAI is the National Museum of the American Indian. So what they're doing, and then also what other major museums are doing with contemporary arts, so that we can all work together to advance the dialogue.
So let's talk about the advancement of the dialogue. Where's the dialogue at? What are people talking about in Indian arts right now?
Well, I would say it's a lot of different places, and that's why I think we need to come together and talk about where the next sort of leap will be, if you will. And the dialogue that I've been involved in at the NMAI has been on a more international level. And the idea was that we would engage non-natives as well to just cross over to more of the contemporary art world and not just the native art world. And so, you know, I think what we want to do is pull together here and have our own, create our own dialogue.
I mean, Fritz Schulder is kind of an interesting crossover person in that sense, because he's culturally wasn't really culturally Indian, but racially he was one quarter Indian, and you look at his face and he kind of looks Indian. And I wondered, you know, when you have somebody who is, you know, visually Indian and who's doing the kind of paintings that he's doing versus a non-native person doing the same kind of paintings, how are they received differently, if they are?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think what Joseph was, when he was talking about Fritz, I was thinking about how he really wanted to be recognized as an artist. He didn't want to be classified. And there are different schools of thoughts. I mean, some Native artists want to be classified as a Native artist, but and then other contemporary artists don't. So I think it's individualistic.
Now, changing gears for a second, you are the museum director. What do museum directors do? I mean, you're talking about the kind of dialogue. Your job is also, what, a lot of fundraising?
Yes. My job will be to develop and cultivate relationships with not only museums, other museums, but also other organizations, and with Indian tribes and, you know, the local Santa Fe audiences. But, yeah, I will also fundraise. And essentially, my goal is to, and my work will be to just facilitate the museum in moving forward. The museum has done a very good job in this past year of transition, and Joseph has been interim director, and he and the staff have done a great job, and so my job will be to move forward and give them a little bit of a break, because Joseph's curating, he's been, you know, directing, he's doing everything. So ideally my goal is to, you know, develop relationships, raise some money.
So then, what are your relationships like with, for example, the local tribes in New Mexico? How do they come into the museum?
Well, this is my first time to live in New Mexico.
Yeah.
And I have...
So you'll find out, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I come here every year for Indian Market. And when I was at Atlatl, I was formerly with Atlatl, a National Service Organization for Native Arts in Phoenix. And we did a lot of national outreach. So we did do some work in the Powaki, for example. But my goal will be to develop relations with the Pueblos and as well as others. I mean, the museum is a national museum.
Right.
So I think it's important to develop relations with local as well as national.
Now, this is a question maybe for both of you, but is there a tension between, you know, between the museum world, which is essentially European and geared toward the individual artist genius like Fritz Schulder, and on the one hand, and then the essential qualities of Native American art, which have traditionally been more non-individualistic and more anonymous, more collective in their spirit?
Well, on that note, this has been discussed a lot, actually, in recent times, and it's the idea, even the site biennial right now, which is talking about community and not only collaboration, but ultimately community and how artists work together and develop a community presentation. So I would say that the Native world is really affecting the world art scene in that way, and that the old hierarchy of the single artist that's the genius is falling away to a more organic kind of a view of what the arts might be.
Very interesting.
And how people can collaborate together, or even community. I like the word community as well.
Right.
But, you know, historically, you're right. Museums have represented ethnic arts and not really focused on contemporary arts. And one reason why I made this push at the NMAI to develop a contemporary art team is they have hired a lot of anthropologists and historians, and everybody's great. We need everybody at the table, but there's not a strong emphasis on contemporary and curating for contemporary, and that's true, basically. And so that's where we're trying to impact.
Well, on that note, it's wonderful to have both of you here. Patsy Phillips, the new director of the Institute of American Indian Arts Museum, Joseph Sanchez, deputy director of the museum and chief curator, and curator of the exhibition Fritz Schulder, An Intimate Look, which opens today from 4 to 6, runs through the 15th of February, 09. Anything that you want to add before we go?
There's a nice conversation on Friday, the 22nd, from 11 to 1. With the curator of the National Museum's exhibition on Fritz Schulder, which is called Indian, Not Indian, and
myself. Is there a lot of the same work that's going to be in this show?
Totally different work.
It's totally different work. Oh, how interesting.
And also with Gerald McMaster is going to be there, who's from the Art Gallery of Ontario, the Canadian curator, who is an II alum as well. So it should be an interesting conversation. We'll be talking about Fritz and the international scene, a more personal view from me, and what the National Museum's curatorial point of view was on this exhibition. So I invite everyone down. It's for free.
Yeah, and I just want to welcome everyone to the museum. Come down and see the show. It's fabulous.
Well, thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz includes an interview with the pianist Bill Mays. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and we will talk to you tomorrow. Bye.